Okay, the tape recorder is rolling. This is David Colburn at the University of Florida. I am interviewing Mr. Charles Hughes, a veteran of World War II. It's December 8th, 2010, and it's approximately 10:20 in the morning. Thank you, Mr. Hughes, for allowing us to interview you.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, we're Thank really you. Happy to have you here.
Thank you.
And where I'd like to start is simply to ask you when you served in the military and what branch.
I was inducted October 10th, 1942, left home on October 24th, 1942, and arrived in Hawaii November 16th of the same year, 1942, and was attached to the Army Air Force, the 8th Air Force, 318th Fighter Group. I spent 19 months in Hawaii. At that time, the government had decided to give the recruits their basic training overseas rather than have it in the States and then ship them out. So we were all, this particular group was sent to Hawaii for their basic training. And that was took 19 months. And at that time I was in the Army, but then I was transferred and attached to the 8th Air Force, the 318th Fighter Group. And from there we went to Saipan, and from Saipan to Aoshima, which is off the coast of Okinawa, and was there when the war ended.
And your rank at that point?
I was a sergeant, and I had gone to school. They put me through a school to learn the defense against chemical warfare. So I was more or less a teacher to show the men how to keep themselves from getting harmed during a chemical raid, which we never had. But showed them how to use their gas masks and their protective clothing, things like that.
Good, that's a good beginning. Yeah. You can sit back, by the way, in that chair and relax because this tape is, record is very powerful.
Good.
And it can pick up your voice, and you've got a strong voice anyway. So let's start with where you grew up and what your mom and dad did.
Well, to start with, I have no idea where I was born, except I have a photostat of a insurance policy, application for an insurance policy, which showed that I was born in Pennsylvania. As far as kin folks, I have no idea if I have anybody in this world. And I was adopted when I was a baby and had these parents until I was about 15, and at that time I was put in an orphan's home, which I was there till I was about 17, and I was adopted out by a gentleman who lived with his mother and father and stayed with them, lived with them till I went into service.
Let me ask you about your first stepmother and father. Where did you grow up? Where did they rear you?
Mostly it was in Warren, Pennsylvania, and in Spartanburg, Pennsylvania, Farrell, Pennsylvania. And unfortunately, it ended up a bad situation. My foster mother became an alcoholic, and my foster father couldn't take it, so he left, and she had remarried, and eventually I think probably I was 14 or 15, she was coming home one night, and we lived in an area where there was a railroad center, freight trains, and exchanged positions to go different directions. And unfortunately, she was walking across the tracks late at night, fell, and the train ran over and killed her. So it was after that that I was put in an orphan's home.
Tell me, give me the date of your birth, or as best you know it, on the...
Well, on this certificate, it's November 16th, 1920.
And as you grew up, were you going to school? Were you working? What were you...
In this orphan's home, I was there probably 2 or 3 years, and it was a wonderful experience. I never regretted one minute of it. We had good treatment, good food, good lodging, and it was, we picked fruit, picked strawberries, we did everything on the farm. We had a big farm, and the products that we produced, we sold to the boats that worked on Lake Erie, freighters and things. We had our own school there at the home, and went through 8th grade, and then they took us to a small town nearby for my 9th and 10th grade, and at that time was when I was taken as adopted by this family in Corry, Pennsylvania. I worked in gas stations, worked in a clothing store, and then I worked for a company that manufactured steel office furniture, desks and filing cases and that.
So you would have been about, this would have been about 1935, 36 when you were...
37 when I was taken out of the home.
Okay. And we were still in the depths of the Depression. It's impressive that a couple would adopt you at that point, since most Americans were really struggling just to make ends meet. Were they a good step?
Beautiful family. Yes, this man's mother and father treated me just like a son, and they had he had a sister that I did work for at her house, painting and one thing and another, before I, when I was in school, I started working at a gas station, worked for good old Texaco, and then I worked in the clothing store and then went to this office furniture company. And as it turns out, this company that made this furniture had a dealership in Honolulu, Hawaii. And when I left and wrote back home, my boss at this company wrote a letter to these people telling them that I was there, and they told me to go see them. So then while I was in Hawaii, every pass that I had, I was a civilian at their house. Lived up in the mountain. It was a beautiful place. It was a nice family.
You finish high school.
1939.
39, and in the intervening years between 39 and 42, when you enter military service, you continue to work for the furniture store at that point?
Well, I started out the gas station, then the clothing store, and then the furniture manufacturer.
Can you give us a sense of what life was like in that period, in the late 30s and 40s? Did you have a sense that things were hard and people were struggling?
I didn't realize it because I had a wonderful family life, and I had a job. I think I started out 75 cents an hour or something like that. But I really wasn't aware of all the... Well, I knew the bread lines and things like that, but locally, we seemed to be doing pretty good.
Did you have a sense of people struggling to make ends meet, needing soup kitchens or anything like that, other than what you might have seen or heard about on the radio?
That's the only thing. I never saw one. I knew that they were there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the war breaks out. Where are you on December 7th,
1942, or 41. 41. My girlfriend and I were in the movie, come out of the theater, and heard about it. It was, as a matter of fact, I was at a point in school where I didn't pay too much attention to what was going on in the world. I mean, I had my own little circle at school and work, you know, so.
And did you have a sense that the bombing at Pearl Harbor was going to change everyone's life?
Oh, yeah, I felt that. We all knew that sooner or later we were going to be in the service. As a matter of fact, I was 21 when I got my notice from the draft board.
And when you got your notice, you got it at home, I assume.
Yes.
And when did it tell you to report for duty?
October 10th. I got the notice, I think it was in February, and then I got a notice to report October 10th to the draft board. And then they gave us 2 weeks between then and the time we were to leave.
I think they were trying to, after Pearl Harbor, absorb all the men, particularly coming into military service. That's probably why you waited until October before you got a draft notice.
They were taking them quite a bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And friends, did any of your circle, did they get draft notices about the same time?
Yes, I had two or three that we left at the same time, but we were separated at Cumberland, Pennsylvania, the camp there. Some went one way and I went on a train all the way to California.
Now, do you know why you were chosen to go to California?
That was always a mystery. We had all kinds of rumors, of course. Some were figured they were going to stay in the States. Some were going to go to Alaska. I can't recall anybody saying Hawaii. But then we learned that they were going to do the basic training there.
And tell me a little bit about when you arrived in Hawaii, what the conditions at the camp were like, and what were you being told, etc.
Well, most of the damage had been cleared up, of course, but all the beaches still had barbed wire on them, and we were stationed at Schofield Barracks for a while, and then we had what they call a tent city. The whole group that I was in lived in tents for most of the 19 months we were there.
Well, Schofield was, of course, one of the targets,
yes,
of the Japanese fighter pilots.
And the Kaneohe Naval Base was hit pretty bad.
Could you still see the damage at the naval base?
Yes, and I can't recall any real damage to downtown Honolulu. Of course, they were probably aiming mostly for the installations there, but it was strange that you didn't see any bombed out buildings in town.
What was your daily regimen like for those 19 months you were in Hawaii?
Just drills and study. The schooling I went through. We had in this tent city, one night they had 14 inches of rain in 11 hours, and soldiers were waking up in their cots with water half in their beds, and barracks bags floating down out of the tents. Never saw anything like it before or since.
Tell us a little bit about the education you were receiving.
Yeah.
What did it involve?
Learning different gases and learning the mechanics of the different chemicals and teaching, learning how to use gas masks properly, using protective clothing. So it was, well, it was kind of dull at times. But I always, after I was transferred to the Air Force, I had to run the enlisted men and the officers through a gas tent for them to learn how to use their gas masks. So that was, it was uncomfortable in most cases.
I remember that well. I went through that myself.
Did you?
It was an unpleasant experience.
It was, yeah.
We had to do it multiple times so that we could take that gas mask off of the pouch and put it on as quickly as possible without breathing.
Yeah, and hold your breath.
And you ended up training, and you didn't go there to be a trainer, but at some point you were selected to be a trainer.
I don't know how I was trained, really.
You must have been a pretty good soldier.
We had pretty exams written and oral exams that we went through. So I guess I learned a little more than some of them did, so I was very fortunate to get what I had.
Of the 19 months in Hawaii, at what for what period were you training enlisted and sold and officers?
I'd say about 8 or 9 months at least.
And then when you got your orders to go to the Pacific, they were assigning you to 8th Air Force.
Yes.
And what unit in the 8th Air Force again?
318th Fighter Group.
318th Fighter Group. And the 318th Fighter Group had what planes? What planes were they flying? What fighter planes?
P-47s. The squadron, the group that I was in, they had different three bases in Hawaii. They'd spend some time at one, flying out of that, and then they transferred to another field there. There's three different fields in Hawaii that we were stationed at. That we lost more planes, I think, to accidents than we did to enemy action. Somewhere I had an article that stated that fact, that we lost more from accidents and flying error than enemy planes.
You went over to the Pacific. That would have been in early 44, I take it, if it's 19 months out from when you entered in October. Would that be about right?
Yeah, it was the middle of 43, I think. We went to Saipan.
Okay, the middle of 43, you went to Saipan. Okay.
And we were there for over a year.
Now, Saipan at that point had been captured by the Marines when you arrived. Is that correct?
Supposedly. When we went in, they held us out in the bay there for a while. But they were still fighting different places on the island. And they had a, up in the mountains, there was a cave that the Japs had a cannon on a rail. And they'd come out one end and they'd shoot, and then they'd come out the other end and shoot. So the Navy and the Army were still having a hard time getting completely secured. But after, as a matter of fact, it wasn't secured when we got there. It was probably 3 or 4 days later. They said it was, but there was still incidents of Japs still fighting away, wouldn't give up.
Well, Saipan was a pretty crucial target and one of the bloodiest invasions and campaigns in American military history in World War II, principally as you described, because the Japanese were dug in these caves that initially the Marines thought it was not going to be much of a challenge, until all of a sudden the Japanese began to emerge from these caves after the places in which they were located were bombed by the Navy. Then they came out after the bombing stopped, and the Marines were in for a long and difficult fight and bloody fight.
Yeah, there was one incident where there was an area that was probably about as big as half of a football field. It was all open space. And the Marines were situated on one side of it. And during one night, the Japanese had been running out of ammunition, were very low. And during the night, they attached bayonets to sticks and started to raid that Marine base at a location. And of course, the Marines just mowed them down something fierce. The next day, a few days later, we went to that area, and there was dead bodies. To walk across the field, you almost had to tiptoe. And I found this one bayonet on the end of a stick that they had used in this charge. So I got the bayonet anyway.
I believe, but I may be wrong, could the P-47 reach Okinawa from Saipan and the Japanese mainland?
I believe they did. They had wing tanks that they put on the plane.
So they could fly a little further.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first B-29s landed on Saipan in October of 43, I think. And the P-47s would escort them when they started bombing Japan.
And when you were stationed there, you were in Saipan, at Saipan how long?
About 11 months.
And you were pretty much staying in, I imagine, tents at that time. There was nothing.
Well,
did you even have tents?
As a matter of fact, we stayed in, there was a abandoned Japanese barracks that was probably 20 or 30 yards long and had doors in the middle on each side and door on each end. There was no doors. I mean, it was open space. And there was a platform on each side of the building inside that was about 8 or 10 inches up off the ground. So we set up our cots and our mosquito nets on that bases there. And one of the strangest experiences I had while we were in that barracks, of course, we had the Japs come over with their planes late at night, and usually it was only one or two. But when we had an air raid, just outside this barracks that we were in was a ditch that was about six foot deep, a cement ditch. And when they had an air raid, we had to go out there and get in that ditch. Well, of course, everybody was on edge all the time, and this ditch was probably 20 or 30 yards from the barracks. I went to sleep. The all clear sounded, and I didn't know it, and nobody woke me up. I had to spend the rest of the night in that trench till daylight so I could go back to the barracks. I didn't dare get out of that trench.
And when you were on Saipan for 10 months, what was your daily routine there?
Well, we had a 300-gallon tank on a truck that I had to go to wherever there was any water available. And then I had also helped a crew fill napalm tanks for the P-47s to bomb, and was shot at one time at that job, but the Marines came and got the sniper. But it was scary, that was all.
Mm-hmm. Well, Saipan was a major base for American air power particularly.
Yeah.
Really a critical base for the ultimate plan to invade Okinawa and Japan.
Yeah, the Tinian was right across. You could see Tinian from Saipan. And the battle was going on over there, too.
I would imagine Tinian was still going on, wasn't it? Because
yeah.
They the Marines went from Saipan to Tinian.
And then I think Guam was right about the same time.
Mm-hmm. What would you, what was Saipan like?
It was mountainous. There's cliffs all around the island. And the strange thing, the Japanese people that were there had heard all kinds of horror stories about how Americans would treat them. And they were jumping off of these cliffs onto the beach and killing themselves, even with the baby in their arms. It was pitiful.
Yeah, their understanding was, they were told by their leaders that Americans would torture them.
Yeah.
Which in reality didn't happen. But they didn't know that.
Yeah.
You were working with the pilots. Did you work with particular crews or
whoever needed us. Yeah,
whoever needed you.
Whoever needed us, yeah.
Yeah. And did most of the guys make it back at the end of the day after their bombing missions?
Yes, we were very fortunate. I can't recall exactly how many we lost in. Like I say, whatever we lost was mostly due to error or engine failure or something like that.
Mm-hmm. The P-47 was one of the, probably the best fighter plane in World War II. Did the pilots and you all have a sense of that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when we were in Hawaii, the Navy had their Hellcat, and the 318th Fighter Group and the Navy would have mock battles almost every day. And unfortunately, thinking of that, one day the tower, when the planes were coming back, the tower decided they were going to land them without radio, but with the light, signal light. And as they peeled off, the planes peeled off and circled around to come in, one plane got directly above another one. And he didn't see that plane. It was right underneath him. And as the lower one hit the runway, the other one landed right on top of him. So that was a sad case, because the pilot was living, jumped out of that plane, and eventually ended up at an insane asylum in the United States.
Saipan, was it hot while you were there? Cold?
I never noticed it being too cold. It was warm, hot, but I don't remember real cold temperatures.
And the vegetation? Lot of greenery?
Yes, it was they're mostly brush and some trees, that hadn't been shot down.
Now, did you get assigned to burial duty at all? With all the bodies out there, I mean, there was a health issue for Americans, obviously.
Yeah.
Get those. Put that up here if you'd like.
It's just a...
Mr. Hughes has got some papers he's showing us. Yeah, there were airstrips on both ends of the island, weren't there?
Yeah.
And now, which section, which part of the island were you, where were you located?
Garapan, where the capital city was.
Okay. So you're located right here, which would have been the west side of the island, right there at Garapan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
One day I thought we thought the island was secure. My partner and I went up in the mountains looking for water. And when I got back, the captain advised me that we had gone into enemy territory and didn't know it because they were still fighting.
I guess you were glad to know that after the fact, weren't you?
Yeah.
Now, you were. Did you go anywhere from Saipan?
From there, we went to Aoshima.
Aoshima, okay.
The island off of Okinawa.
Nawa, yeah, one of the very small islands of Okinawa.
That's the island where Ernie Pyle, the war correspondent, was killed.
Killed, yeah. And how long were you at Aoshima?
It was about 4 or 5 months before the war ended.
Okay, so while you were there, they were planning the invasion of Japan.
Right.
Which was prevented by the use of the two atomic bombs. Mm-hmm. Did you, what was your role in planning for the invasion? What job were you going to have?
They never told me anything.
Really?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me what you did at Aoshima.
Just the usual taking care of the equipment and helping with the napalm bombs. There was not much for us to do over there. All the fighting had been over. Between Aoshima and Okinawa, at one time there was probably 40 or 50 ships out there, and the main one was the one that controlled the South Pacific and all the operations of the Navy and all. And one day there was a Jap bomber came in, and it went the full length of the island, and the anti-aircraft was shooting at it and missed everything. They got all the way down at the end of the island. I turned around, and it made a beeline for that control ship, the big ship there. And about the time it got there, there was two shots from a Navy ship, and the bomber was gone. Never made it. So everybody was thankful for that.
Yeah, I guess the thought was if they knocked out that ship,
oh, they'd have controlled it, yeah.
Yeah.
They'd have knocked everything for a loop.
What that was somebody like Admiral Halsey on that ship?
That I can't say. I don't know, mm-hmm. but somebody higher up, I'm mm-hmm. sure, was there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And did you have a sense while you were at Aoshima that the war was coming to a close, or was there no sense of that at all?
No, we felt that there was still going to be an invasion of some time with all the bombings that they were doing. And
was everybody worried about the invasion? What was the conversation like between you and your colleagues?
Well, we knew if it was an invasion that it was going to be a bloody mess, more than any battle that they had been in. And we were hoping that the bombings that we were doing every day would keep them from having to go. But like you say, the atomic bombs solved that problem.
Now you were basically stayed in the Pacific this entire time. Now some of the Marines they brought back to Hawaii to be retrained for subsequent invasions, but you stayed there.
I was there from the day I left home until I got back. When the war ended, they had a point system for those that won that were going to be discharged, and I had my choice of flying home in 3 days or taking a boat, and it would take about a week or 10 days. Well, I've always been scared of flying. Flying scares me to death. But having been there so long, I said, what the heck, I'll go ahead and fly home. So.
Tell us what dates those were.
Let's see.
It would have been after...
After the bombing.
So maybe August the 15th or 20th, somewhere in there?
No, I was there after
45?
That because
okay.
I didn't get back to the States until the middle or latter part of October.
Okay. That's good enough.
So we were assigned a B-29 to come back. And like I say, they said it was going to be 3 days and we'd be home. But we flew from Aishima to Tinian, landed at Tinian, and due to the inclement weather that was in the forecast, we were there for 6 days. And when we got left there, we landed at Kwajalein. And Kwajalein had an airstrip. It was from one end of the island to the other. And when I was in the radar room, was my position on the plane, and there was a bubble on the side of the plane. And when the pilot started to take off, he was down at the end of the runway, and he went to start it up that runway, and we kept going and going and going and going. And I sat there and I thought, are we going to get off the ground? And I looked out to went at that bubble, and just he raised the plane just a little bit and bounced it, and I looked out that bubble and there was the water underneath the plane. Oh, we made it.
How many of you were on the plane?
I think there was 12 of us.
12 of us.
Yeah. I was in the radar room, and The captain that was there with us, he noticed we had our Mae West on, we had a parachute on, and he noticed that I was just as tense as could be. That's when we left Aishima. And he says, take those things off. You don't need them. Lay down there. I took them off and laid down. I was asleep in 2 minutes. So the next morning, I woke up and he said, you want to see a sight? I said, yeah. So they had a seat there that went up into a dome at the top of the plane. And he put me in that seat and raised it up. And just as I got to the top of the plane where that dome was, I looked out over, there was nothing but clouds as far as the eye could see, but it was beautiful. But I was still nervous all the way home.
Well, did you write home when you were...
Yes, I wrote just probably 2 or 3 times a week.
And what did you tell them?
Just told them I was fine and that I didn't describe any situations or anything like that. If it was something minor that I did that day, I'd tell them, but there was no nothing to... excite him or worry him.
Right. You folks were all like that, it seems to me, that everybody that rode home and rode home regularly never described any of the dangers.
No.
It almost sounded like you were on rest and relaxation instead of in a war front.
Yeah. Another thing that I noticed when we all got notice that we were going to go home, you never heard one of us or one of them say, well, I'll be home tomorrow or I'll be home next week, or because there was always that thought in the back of your mind, anything could happen between the time you left and got home. Mm-hmm. So we just kept quiet about that.
Now, where were you? Do you remember where you were when you heard that the first atomic bomb had been dropped at Hiroshima?
They were there at Aishima.
And do you remember, how did you get the news? Do you recall?
I think it was a Army paper they put out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, did you have any idea what an atomic bomb was?
Not the least. No, no sir. No, well, just the pictures that we finally got released, that we realized what a thing it was.
And that was August 6th, and then August 9th, they dropped the bomb at Nagasaki.
Nagasaki.
And between the 6th and the 9th, the Japanese refused to surrender acknowledge that the war was over. So they dropped the second bomb. I imagine you veterans had no hesitancy or reluctance about the use of the atomic bomb.
No. No, we knew it saved... We knew it saved a lot of lives. Speaking of the end of it, General Douglas MacArthur ordered the envoys that were going to Manila to start the peace talks. I got a picture somewhere of he had them land at Aishima on the way to Manila. We saw them out on that tarmac.
Mm-hmm. What sort of celebrations occurred when the word came the war was over?
You know, I don't think there was any much jubilation. I mean, it was just, thank goodness it's over with, and maybe we'll get to go home.
When did you hear that the war in Europe was over? You must have been, let's see, you probably were...
I was at Saipan.
Saipan at that time, yeah.
Yeah, we knew, we figured that the Pacific would get a lot more help from the Air Force. As a matter of fact, the 7th Air Force, which flew B-24s, they came to Aishima, I remember that.
Yeah, so they were already, while you were there, they'd already begun to transition troops from Europe and the European theater to the Asian theater.
I don't remember much about that, really.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I was interested in... hoping that we could get out of there and get home after all that time.
Was there a sense that after the war in Europe ended that maybe it wasn't going to be too much longer before?
Yeah, like I say, we figured, we would get a lot more help from the infantry and the Marines and the Air Forces to come to the Pacific.
But the horror of invading Japan after Saipan and Iwo Jima, Tinian, I must have been ever present in people's minds.
Oh yeah.
Knowing what it was going to take to invade Japan.
Yeah, it would have been a horrible situation, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think we all agree that the loss of life would have been much more substantial, both for Americans, obviously, but also for the Japanese.
Yeah.
If the bombs weren't used. Well, you came home. When you arrived home, was there a welcome ceremony? Did they roll out the red carpet for you?
No, wasn't much to that. when we landed at Camp Colvin in California, we were there for a few days, and then we were put on a train and came back the northern route to Chicago, and then to Dayton, Ohio, where was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and were discharged there.
You were discharged almost immediately upon arrival?
In Daytona.
At Wright Air Force Base,
yeah. That was in 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. And when you went home, what was the reception like at home? Did you have a girlfriend at that point?
Well, as a matter of fact, when I was in Hawaii, she and I had been going together for quite a while, and I bought a diamond ring in Honolulu, paid $78 for it, and I sent it to my guardian and asked him to give it to her. So she had the diamond when I got home.
And how much longer before you got married?
See, I got home in October. We got married January 5th, 1946. He was born in 47. His brother was born in 49. And his sister was born in 1954 in Avon Park.
Now, when you got married, did you stay in the state of Pennsylvania, and what did you do?
Well, I went back to work for the furniture manufacturer. Then opened up a branch office in Philadelphia, and I lived there with that for a while. Then I moved to Baltimore when I left the company, and went to work manufacturing combination storm windows, which we don't have in Florida, but we did there.
Mm-hmm.
And this one had an asthmatic condition when he was small. And my wife's parents had Gap Cabins and Gift Shop in Avon Park. And he would be sick 1 week and well the next. So I decided to send him and his mother and his brother to Florida. And they were down here, I don't know, maybe a month. And when he came back, he was just as clear as could be. The asthmatic condition had cleared up. So we decided that we were going to move to Florida. That was in 1950.
And you obviously didn't opt to take the GI Bill and go back to school, I mean, because you were building a family, I guess.
Right.
So you needed to find a way to work and support everybody.
Yeah.
Did you have a sense that America was really, the economy was stronger, that people were in a better frame of mind after the war than before the war?
Yeah, because the furniture business picked up, and when we went in Baltimore, we had all we could handle manufacturing, so seemed to be good. And then when we moved to Florida, I worked for National Standard Coffee Company out of Louisiana, and then I went in, worked for Borden's Dairy for about 3 years, and moved to Lakeland in 1950 to went in the insurance business.
56. Where were you before Lakeland?
Avon Park.
And then Sebring.
We were in Sebring.
Yeah,
we're Sebring. That's where I worked for Borden's Dairy.
Did you ever get together with any of your fellow veterans from the war after the war was over?
I only had one, and that was the one that was with me all during the war. He came to visit.
What was his name?
Giles Ragsdale. As a matter of fact, he came, dated a friend of mine that I graduated with from school. And I thought for a while we were going to continue to be close together, but he finally left. And I forget where he moved to, but I hadn't heard from him since.
When was the last time you and he had contact?
That's 48, somewhere along there.
And as you look back on the war, where does it fit into your own memory in terms of the things you've done?
Well, as hard as it was, I wouldn't give up that experience for anything in the world. It was difficult at times. As a matter of fact, it was somewhere I've got a letter that I'd written to my guardian, explaining to him how our morale at that time was down so far because we had been promised time and time again that we'd be relieved and sent back for rest, but never happened. But outside of that particular time, I guess I have no regrets at all.
And what made it so particularly meaningful that you not only have no regrets, but you have good memories about what you did? What is it about that that makes it so special in your own words?
Well, the satisfaction that I did a good job. The people that I've worked for in the service seemed to appreciate what I was doing. I don't remember many complaints about my behavior or my work that I was doing.
And that in your own way, you played a vital role in protecting your nation and the folks back home.
Well, I hope so.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, you raised a family. How did you find your way to Gainesville?
Well,
or just outside of Gainesville, we should say.
No, this moved to Gainesville. We
moved
from Sebring to Lakeland, Florida, where I went was in the insurance business, and then when I retired, I went to work. In 1977, I went to work part time for Public Supermarkets as a bagger. And I still work 2 days a week, 4 hours a day, bagging groceries. I've been in the same store for 13 years.
Tell us what store that is.
It's at South Publix Supermarkets, and it's at Southgate in Lakeland, Florida.
Well, I wonder if they realize how important their bagger is in the history of the United States.
Yeah, I think they're very aware of how we treat customers and know that our actions help business too.
Well, tell me, is there anything we haven't covered that we ought to talk about? You grew up in a very difficult circumstance, and yet, in terms of your own life, you've led a very stable life and had a wonderful family. And I imagine that experience when you were a young man influenced both growing up as an orphan, but then your military service gave you a perspective on life that was a bit different maybe from other people.
Well, that experience at the home was well worth it. I have no regrets about it. The treatment was fine. We had good living accommodations. We had a nice school. We had one teacher taught sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And we had a gymnasium with the basketball court. We played baseball. We had a very nice, very good life. Outside the weeding and a rows of corn or whatever it was. No regrets.
My suspicion is that you're a person that always sees the positive.
Well, that drives my wife crazy. She has, as a matter of fact, she has a granddaughter up in New York State. Several years ago, we were up there, and my wife was complaining about something or other, and her granddaughter says, "Grandma, you're a pessimist." So, more or less, she is, and I'm the optimist.
Well, Mr. Hughes, thank you for sharing your story with us. I'm very appreciative to have the chance to talk to you.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and I thank you for the time. I hope we did a good job.
I think you did a good job. Thank you.